I'm going to turn the program over to Robin Proud. Welcome, Robin.
Thank you so much. Good to see everybody. And welcome. The Free Congregation of Sauk County is a welcoming congregation. This means that our welcome is for all, regardless of race, religious background, sexual orientation, gender expression, and even political party. Fritz is going to light the candle. You probably will need to, you're off camera though, Fritz, so you may need to move or move the screen so that people can see that. Oh, there we go. Oh, it's perfect. Never mind. All right. I just have one sentence here from the book Cast by Isabel Wilkerson. As we go about our daily lives, cast is the wordless usher in a darkened theater. Flashlight cast down in the aisles, guiding us to our assigned seats for a performance. The hierarchy of cast is not about feelings or morality. It is about power, which groups have it and which do not. I have a reading from Cast by Isabel Wilkerson. We in the developed world are like homeowners who inherited a house on a piece of land that's beautiful on the outside, but whose soil is unstable loam and rock, heaving and contracting over generations. Cracks patched, but the deeper ruptures waved away for decades, centuries even. Many people might rightly say, I had nothing to do with how all this started. I have nothing to do with the sins of the past. My ancestors never attacked indigenous people, never owned slaves. And yes, not one of us was here when this house was built. Our immediate ancestors may have had nothing to do with it, but here we are. The current occupants of a property with stress cracks and bowed walls and fissures built into the foundation. We are the heirs to whatever is right or wrong with it. We did not erect the uneven pillars or joists, but they are ours to deal with now. And any further deterioration is in fact in our hands. During the summer, one of the programs that Prairie Unitarian Universalist in Madison featured was by a minister from the First Universalist Church in Minneapolis. And as we were saying before, this is one of the few benefits of our era. We can gather from around the country. We can have speakers literally from around the world. So I logged on to see this presentation about a book called White Trash. I knew that was given by Reverend Karen of the First Universalist Church. Imagine my surprise when I found out Reverend Karen talking about white trash is a Black woman. Now, she herself joked about having the name that now stands for a quintessential middle-class white lady. We found her talk very interesting, and we decided at Prairie to create a study group to read this book and then some others. So I'll be talking about a few of those today, focusing on class in America. Now, the full title of this book by Nancy Eisenberg is White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America. The main thesis is that the promise of all men are created equal has never been thoroughly believed or supported in this country, even for white Anglo-Saxon men. I didn't realize that the early American colonies served Britain much as Australia did later, as a place to dump the undesirables, the petty criminals, and the unemployed. Eisenberg shows that much of what we learned in school about the Pilgrims, the Enlightenment thinkers, the Founding Fathers, is a cover-up. John Locke accepted the existence of a permanent underclass. Benjamin Franklin thought the English were too charitable to the poor. They should be moved to the hinterlands of America to sink or swim. And our hero at Park Hall, Thomas Paine, dismiss differences of wealth and success as phenomena of nature or accident. Thomas Jefferson joined many thinkers of his time in applying to humans the new science of breeding, which they were then using with horses and dogs. Well, all of these thinkers acknowledged a group of people that they called waste, rubbish, brutes. This became a self-fulfilling prophecy in many places. Land was given or sold by charter. It was not evenly shared in most places. In the South, of course, wealth came from slaves. For anyone not of the upper classes, it was difficult to acquire and work land. A small farm of free men could never compete with a plantation and its automatic labor. The group that would be called white trash, as well as crackers, mudsills, hillbillies, were forced into the less desirable areas of scrub and swamp. Or they became a new sort of peons, working as sharecroppers under landlords who always got the better deal. They were criticized for their ill health, which was natural due to malnutrition. They were criticized for their ignorance, although they had no chance to education. And they were criticized for their squalor, although there was, of course, a lack of sanitation. These individuals continued to be looked down on through American history. They were likely to be conscripted into the Confederate Army to defend a system that had never benefited them. In return, though, they did tend to desert in sizable numbers when they weren't getting paid or the crops at home needed attention. But through all this time, the poorest white man knew that he was superior to someone. Lyndon Johnson has a great quote. He said, "I'll tell you what's at the bottom of it. If you can convince the lowest white man he's better than the best colored man, he won't notice you're picking his pocket. Hell, give him somebody to look down on, and he'll empty his pockets for you." Those on top knew that if poor whites and poor blacks ever united, they could seriously threaten the existing power structure. It was relatively easy to keep these groups hostile to each other, and I would say it remains so today. Now, throughout the centuries, there has been a certain pushback to the denigration of poor whites, an insistence that these despised people were nonetheless the real Americans. They supposedly embodied independence, creativity, and resilience. But much of this is belied by lived experience. As we'll see in the next book that I'm going to talk about, many of you may have read this. It got a lot of attention a few years ago. It is Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Vance. Is anybody familiar with that book? Now, I actually didn't read it at the time because of my own bias. I knew that the author calls himself a conservative, so I assumed that the book would be a justification of his people, why they're being overlooked, and therefore why they're turning to certain political parties or figures or behaviors. Well, there's a bit of that, but mostly he's very critical of his own culture. He refers to someone who quits a job because he doesn't like to get up early, then blames the world for his unemployment. He cites parents who don't value education for their children, instead going into debt to buy them expensive toys for Christmas. He exposes the literally toxic masculinity that sees every look as a threat and every approach as a challenge. He portrays a culture of pessimism and fatalism, the sense that people have no effect in the trajectory of their lives. And there's a strong resentment of anybody who gets government handouts. He talked about how susceptible his group was to conspiracy theories. And this was in 2016, before the election of that year. If anything, that would be more true today. One thing I learned from this book that I didn't know was that parallel to the great migration of Black workers from the South to Northern industrial cities, many of these so-called hillbillies left places like Kentucky to work in factories in Indiana, Ohio, Illinois, and other states. And in many ways, their culture wasn't that different from the Black migrants. They were mostly rural people. They found it normal to grow food and kill chickens in their new backyards, which their neighbors didn't always approve of. They kept strong ties to their original homes, visiting regularly and often sending the children for a whole summer back home, which was traditional with Black families as well. That's how Emmett Till ended up spending the summer in the South. They were part of extended clans that didn't always fit the conventional scenario. A simple question like, "How many brothers and sisters do you have?" is a landmine when your mother has been married more than once and had multiple other partners, many of whom had children with other people. In adulthood, Vance realized he suffered from a form of PTSD from the many traumatic incidents of his childhood. Frequent moves, yelling, fighting, physical violence as a norm at home, alcoholism, drug use, suicide attempts in the home. To him, this was just life. And many of his friends had the same background. In a sense, he says he grew up in a culture foreign to success. Now, because of several factors, he ended up going to college and law school and learned how to deal with the new world. It wasn't until he was in law school he learned how to deal with multiple spoons and forks at dinner, or that he should wear a suit to a job interview. He admits that even as an adult, he has to constantly struggle with the temptation to get out of his car and attack anyone who cuts him off in traffic. As a high school student, Vance read a book by sociologist William Julius Wilson called The Truly Disadvantaged. It described perfectly the milieu he lived in, people who migrated for factory jobs, which later disappeared. As it happened, this book was about the Black community, but he saw that it applied just as well to his own world. So many of the things that he mentions that would help his community would also help other marginalized groups. At one point, Vance's mother almost killed him by crashing the car. Vance refused to speak against her in court, knowing he was a child at the time. His mother could be sent to jail and he would be sent to strangers to a foster home. Instead, the family worked out an arrangement for him to move in with his grandmother, who, although quite a character, was one of the better influences in his life. You might know there's a movie that's coming out soon. Glenn Close is playing the grandmother. But working class and lower class families, white, Black, Native American, Latino, often have extended clan relationships that are not easily recognized by the state. A child might be sent away to a totally foreign environment. Vance also describes how he grew up thinking that academic success was for sissies, and being a man was the most important value in life, so education was not a good idea. This same perception applies in much of the Black and Latino community. When my daughter graduated in 1998 from a racially diverse school in Minneapolis, it was big news in the newspaper that the valedictorian was a Black male. That had never happened. He was also star of the football team, which probably reduced the threat to his masculinity. Vance concludes, there's a cultural movement in the white working class to blame problems on society or the government. And this was written before the 2016 elections, but it helps explain maybe in that year and this one, why so many people would vote for a candidate who basically ran against government. But Vance goes on, Vance says, here is where the rhetoric of modern conservatives, and I say this as one of them, fails to meet the real challenges of their biggest constituents. Instead of encouraging engagement, conservatives increasingly foment the kind of detachment that has sapped the ambition of so many of my peers. And he mentions how many of them have had trouble with drugs, early parenthood, and incarceration. He says, what separates the successful from the unsuccessful are the expectations that they had for their own lives. Yet the message of the right is increasingly, it's not your fault that you're a loser, it's the government's fault. Now, I would add that it's also often portrayed as the fault of someone else. It's immigrants, it's Black people, it's women, it's the elites who are taking something away from you. The Pew Economic Mobility Project found there is no group of Americans more pessimistic than working class whites, and perhaps with reason, as many are worse off than their parents. For those who do succeed, there's constant stress, similar to that experienced by Black and Latino strivers. They don't quite fit in their old culture anymore. But in the new world, they don't quite fit in either. Vance says, one way our upper class can promote upward mobility is not only by pushing wise public policies, but by opening our hearts and minds to the newcomers who don't quite belong. So that's what I wrote a week ago. But this week I saw an article by a woman named Kayla Ray Whitaker. She's a writer who comes from the same part of the country, and she also left for education and career. She sees Vance's book and the upcoming movie as dangerous. And it's similar to the remark Jared Kushner made recently about Black people have to want success more. She's concerned that by putting this on individual responsibility, Vance is setting aside the structural issues that led to the current status of Appalachia. She says, the story that Vance's book offers is one of people who cannot help or save themselves. from laziness, from addiction, from a failure to develop the self-respect necessary to pull themselves up within an economy and social system that prevents them at every turn. And I would say this is similar to things that have been written about the Black community and how they were inherently flawed. She reminds us large corporate interests seized control of the Appalachian region's natural resources just after the Civil War, generating huge profits from coal and timber while workers toiled in dangerous conditions for shoddy wages. There's a wonderful fiction book called Serena that takes place in North Carolina with the logging during the Depression. People would come in, they were desperate for a job, they had no safety equipment, they would routinely get killed and the timber people would just hire a new person. And of course, mining, extremely dangerous. These corporate forces fought unionization at every turn with brutality and out and out murder. The area's real history is defined by locals fighting these forces in organized, principled fashion. One of these you might be familiar with is fighting against the Duke Power Company in the 1976 documentary, Harlan County, USA. So she goes on, Kayla Ray Whitaker goes on to say, one questions what this narrative of hillbilly elegy is meant to inspire in its audience. For those outside the region, it reinforces the understanding that Appalachia is not worth financial and political investment. Let's engage in honest exchanges about how one's chances for financial security and professional success rely more upon one's geography, community, and particular occupied notch in the socioeconomic ladder rather than on the notion of individual grit. And another book, which I did not read but plan to, is Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope by Nicholas Kristof and his wife, Cheryl Wu Dunn. A short summary of that says, drawing us deep into an other America, the authors tell the story through the lives of some of the people with whom Kristof grew up in rural Oregon. It's an area that prospered for much of the 20th century, but has been devastated in the last few decades as blue-collar jobs disappeared. About a quarter of the children on Kristof's old school bus died in adulthood from drugs, alcohol, suicide, or reckless accidents. So Kristof himself is a kind of cross-cultural ambassador. Now he's an internationally known writer for the New York Times and author of several books. Every time he would write a column about the problems of people that he still knew from growing up with them, many New York Times readers would write in blaming the subjects for their bad choices. But they live in a world where no good choices are visible. Looking at these structural issues always makes me wonder about whether capitalism and an equal society can ever coexist. It seems very Marxist. It's all about who has the money and the means of production. And Vance ended with an appeal for those who have made it to welcome others. Kayla Ray Whitaker in her essay also included a personal section where she stated she gets dismissed or ridiculed for her accent, being from Kentucky. And this is probably being done in places like New York, where she has been. It's being done by people who consider themselves welcoming and even woke. Now, the last book I'm going to talk about today is Cast, The Origins of Our Discontents by Isabel Wilkerson. Isabel Wilkerson won several prizes for her earlier book, The Warmth of Other Suns, about the Black migration. The first book I talked about, White Trash, is written in a very scholarly manner. It's full of footnotes, and it never gives one example what five will do. It's somewhat dry and repetitive. Cast, on the other hand, is one of the most beautifully written books I have ever read, fiction or nonfiction. Wilkerson's use of metaphors, analogies, and anecdotes is perfect. They're both arresting in their originality and obvious in their applicability once you see them. For instance, the metaphor of the old house. For all of us who say, well, I had nothing to do with the past, here you are. She has another little section where she makes up a world where tall and short would be the determiners of power and opportunity, and it shows how ridiculous that system is. So I'll just give you a couple brief things from the book. She defines caste, C-A-S-T-E. Caste is the granting or withholding of respect, status, honor, attention, privileges, resources, benefit of the doubt, and human kindness to someone on the basis of their perceived rank or standing in the hierarchy. And just that benefit of the doubt one really grabbed me, that if it had been a Black person with a gun in Kenosha, that person would not have been thanked by police, allowed to leave, arrested later at home, released on bail, or even these simple things like people being having police called on them for being in a coffee shop, at a swimming pool, and other everyday events. Well, Wilkerson looks at how caste has been defined and enforced in three societies, the United States, India, and Nazi Germany. Many of us at Prairie didn't know that when the Nazis wanted to limit and contain the Jews, they looked for ideas to American Jim Crow laws. They actually got hold of these laws and went through them. Now, they were surprised that Americans didn't count Jews as Black, but they found plenty of ideas to borrow, including marriage bans, restrictions on professions, and an emphasis on purity. Tellingly, the Nazis didn't feel they could go as far as the Americans. The Americans had the one-drop rule. If you have one drop of Black blood, you're Black. It was possible, at least legally, for Germans with a small amount of Jewish ancestry and who did not practice Judaism to be designated as non-Jews. And I'll just briefly mention the eight pillars of caste that Wilkerson discusses. Number one is divine will and the laws of nature. So God and or nature ordained this. So obviously no disputing it. Number two, heritability. Caste is transmitted to your offspring and can't be overcome. Number three, control of marriage and mating. These could be government or church restrictions on marriage. Number four, purity versus pollution, from the River Ganges to the American swimming pool. Number five, occupational hierarchy, most developed in India, but it's absolutely been present in eras of US history. Number six is dehumanization and stigma. In order to accept this system, the upper castes must see the lower as other and not really human. Number seven is terror and cruelty as enforcement, torture of the enslaved, massacres, lynching, and so on. And second. And number eight, I thought I had. All right, inherent superiority versus inferiority. So this is ranking in everyday activities, like who gets to be in the front or back of the bus. Someone has to move off the sidewalk for another person. Well, the world created by these pillars has terrible consequences for the lower castes, but it also affects the upper caste. These people feel that success and adulation is their due. Anything that looks like increased equality feels to them like an encroachment or a loss. And there is a loss today of economic security and life expectancy among some people who have lived with the expectation of always being on top, that is, white middle-aged men. So let's look at ourselves and our surroundings. In one aspect, those of you living outside Madison may encounter more diversity than some of us in a supposedly diverse city. A book group I was in Madison was discussing a book called Empire Falls by Richard Russo, which takes place in a small town. One of our members said he couldn't really relate to the small town story. In his life, he had only lived three places, New York City, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and Madison. He had traveled the world, but he had no experience in rural or small town America. A few years ago, there was a popular online quiz asking, "Do you live in a bubble?" It asked questions about education level and income, but also things like, "Have you ever eaten at a Cracker Barrel restaurant? Have you ever bought any Avon products? Can you identify this NASCAR driver?" And in fact, in the recent election, we heard about the Cracker Barrel versus Whole Foods dichotomy. You can predict how the district would vote by the prevalence of one or the other in your county. So how does this apply to our lives? If you have a visitor to your society who tells you about their child in high school, do you automatically ask about college plans? Do you refer to programs on public radio or TV as if everyone should recognize them? What suggestions do you have to increase the welcome in this or any community? And then maybe some of you can share, are you transplants from another culture? Are any of you willing to admit to times when you have blindly enforced the established order or just been tone deaf? Years ago, when I was a new teacher, I called a Black student by the name of another Black student. The student understandably reacted, and I realized I had never done that to white students. I also had the conversation of asking someone where he was from because of his skin color and last name appearing South Asian, when the answer for him was Iowa. So I would love to hear anybody's thoughts on experiences that you've had or ideas you have about widening circles and being welcoming and just anything to do with class and caste in America. One thing I was going to mention, Ellen, also from what Brianne said too, that some people have an option to pass. That is, certainly people who had some Black ancestry who looked light enough were able to move away and become something else. Some people were able to get out of Germany. People were, there were certainly people who were blonde and blue-eyed who happened to be Jewish but could pass. Brianna, you have a chance to reinvent yourself in a new place. But for most Black people, it is not possible to, for even a minute to be able to escape from other people looking and judging you. I'm sorry, I don't know who is with me. It says Melanie. It's wonderful. I started reading at 10 o'clock at night. I kept reading till 2 a.m. I read the whole thing. So his personal story is wonderful. And I'm not a supporter of the military in general, but for him and for some other people with chaotic lives, the military gave him a structure. He was forced to become physically fit, to know he could overcome things he didn't think he could do. And the military teaches people to do everything. They taught him taught him about hygiene, how to open a bank account, things that were not in his community. But yes, then when he went to college and heard these freshmen spouting off about what we should be doing in Afghanistan or Iraq, and he had actually been there. So he ended up finishing college in like a year and a half because he wasn't interested in the college life side of it. Yeah, he just wanted to get through. Obviously a really smart person, but earlier in school, yeah, he was not doing well at all because it wasn't important to him. And but yes, he credited his grandmother. And then college, he was still intimidated by a lot of professors or didn't feel like he would have anything in common. In law school, his mentor was Amy Chua, is it? She's the one who wrote about the Tiger Mother. She actually became a mentor to him, but it was natural that he wouldn't trust authority figures, which is often true of minority students. They do not feel comfortable going to a professor's hours or office hours or knowing what to do. So yeah, very good points. Yes, the book is very compelling. And I'm sure the movie will be good. I think it's Glenn Close, Amy Adams. I'm not sure who else. All right. And yes, and it's an ongoing discussion. We had one presentation at Prairie also about the moving walkway, that in a sense, we're all on that walkway at the airport that takes you slowly along. And that is where racism, classism, and so on, homophobia, all of these things are sort of there. And it's one thing to say, well, I'm going to walk slower. What we are challenged to do is to actually get off and start going back the other way or making amends. And that's complicated. So thank you, everyone. And all right, I do have I'll read the very final part so that we have some hope here at the end of cast. And then we have a postlude. So the way that she ends this, in a world without caste, instead of a false swagger over our own tribe or family or ascribed community, we would look upon all of humanity with wonderment. In a world without caste, being male or female, light or dark, immigrant, native born would have no bearing on what anyone was perceived as being capable of. In a world without caste, we would all be invested in the well-being of others in our species, if only for our own survival, and recognize that we are in need of one another more than we have been led to believe. We would join forces with indigenous people around the world, raising the alarm as fires rage and glaciers melt. We would see that when others suffer, the collective human body is set back from the progression of our species. A world without caste would set everyone free.
Thank you, Robin.
You're welcome. It's great to see you.